Good morning, good morning. We are dancing in with Soul Mikasa, Mano Dibango. This is Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, right here in the place to be, CJSF Radio 90.1, with your Friday Speak Up Show. Have we got a treat in store for you.
Hello, this is Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, here at the place to be, CJSF Radio 90.1 Burnaby, CJSF CA, streaming worldwide. Today, you are getting two for one. You're hearing a very interesting interview with Dr. Ramona, part of the Powered by Age podcast, and of course, our Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon. You're going to get some things around the theme of transition that you might want to act upon in your own life. So without further ado, I'm going to bring the remarkable, renowned, world citizen. She is speaking from us. She's active with Powered by Age in Vancouver, and she has been active with people, a senior center in Toronto. And like me, I'm between two cities, bringing you people internationally. So you're going to have a rich, rich, rich program this morning. So Dr. Ramona, say hello.
Hello. Hello, everyone. And hello, Charlotte. I'm feeling a bit overawed by that introduction. I hope I can live up to it. But it's really wonderful being on this podcast with you.
Yes, and we're talking about transition. We have who are of the baby boom related generation. We're from the group that changed the world. We rock this mothership. And so the changes that we've had to go through over the past 2 years, being shut down, then partially out, then thinking that we would be back fully up, things are opening up again. But within your life, there's some transitions we're going to talk about this morning. And one is just that transition from India over into Vancouver. What is one of the things you can say about transition in world space, location?
Well, the first thing the difference I found was the silence and the very pure, sterile atmosphere. So in India, I'm from Bombay, so where we have a lot of people and traffic and honking. And when I landed in Toronto, it was so silent, I thought there was a curfew going on. And then later I realized that people don't honk so much here, very rarely do. And then the next thing was the weather. In Bombay, it's hot, hotter, hottest. So we don't have much of a change except the monsoons when it rains for a couple of months. But here it was really cold. I think I landed here at the end of August. And I thought that was winter. So, but then later realized that winter is several months ahead. And so I had to get used to a whole lot of things. I saw snow for the first time, and then there was freezing rain, and it was, but all through the sun was shining, which really made me very happy, but it also confused me. The first time I saw the sun out, I just rushed out and it was so cold. Then I realized there's no link between the sun shining and the temperature. So
that was similar to an experience I had in coming from Los Angeles over into Vancouver, because I've lived in Toronto. I think there was a lot more sun. There was definitely more sun in LA, but the days when there would be overcast and rain, I had to get over this notion in my mind, I'm going to be depressed, and just look forward to the part of the day when the sun would come out, or get used to in the morning it's sunny, but by midday it's gray and there's rain. So, and I felt also that it was very cold, because at the end of August it's really, really hot in Southern California, and it was cold.
Really, really cold. And so, but when I love the fact that when you're inside, we lived in a condo initially, and there was central heating And so one didn't feel any kind of difference, except if one had to step out. Then it was like even my eyeballs felt they were freezing. It was so cold.
People would laugh at me on my street because I lived, when I first came, I was living with my daughter at a place that was close to commercial and Broadway. And I had my coat. I just would not go out without, not my heaviest coat, but a coat that zipped up. And people would look at me and they would fan and they would say, and point to the sky like it's hot. And I thought, it's 40 degrees. It is cold. But what did you think about dress? Did you have any transitions in the way that you felt comfortably dressing in India and the way you felt dressing here?
Oh, yeah. In India, I wore something called a sari and also something called salwar kameez, where you have a kind of tunic and you have loose trousers below that. But I guess that wouldn't work here. So I adopted, wearing trousers and a top. That seemed to work well. And also footwear. I was used to wearing open-toed sandals, but here it had to be all like socks and closed shoes and boots, and so that was another difference in attire. But I think I prefer it. It's like rather easier to move about, more casual than the sari is. They're sort of a little difficult to manage and to be careful about, the fabric and kinds of things like that.
So, and how is, speaking of fabrics and having a sari that's got a skirt or as opposed to pants within religion or religious practice, do you find any difficulties in not wearing a traditional dress, or is there something, maybe you could explain Goa and your religion, and also what are some of the expectations regarding dress?
Certain religions, like say the Hindu religion, would require that women are covered completely from, I wouldn't say head to toe, but at least, most of their body is covered. And the sari has a part of it which we call the pallav, which you could pin up on one shoulder. But if you are in a temple, then you're expected to pull it over the other shoulder as well, or some kind of religions expect you to cover your head as well with that part of the pallav. So this is different. I haven't actually been to many temples in Toronto. I did go to one, but I noticed that ladies here adapt to the same kind of attire that I was wearing, and that if we have to follow that, then you had a kind of a scarf which could be, you could wrap it around your head and shoulders and thereby satisfy that requirement of being mostly covered. So that is different, except that I feel that the sari looks very beautiful.
Yes.
Like, you have different like silk ones, and then they are embroidered with gold thread, and they really look very, very beautiful, different colors. And what I wear now is rather kind of like a uniform. So it doesn't look that pretty, but it's it helps us to move about easier. Like I can imagine the sari and everything flying up with a strong in Toronto. So that won't happen. There's no danger of that happening with the trousers and top. So it's better like to wear that kind of thing. Except maybe if there are special occasions, so then we can resort to our Indian attires, like a celebration of our festivals.
Yes.
Diwali. So we could wear that.
Now, I think it's probably also very practical if you are taking things like the the Skyway. I want to call it a subway, but the Skyway, the SkyTrain.
Right.
When you have to get on the elevator or take the stairs, when that would be less awkward.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you think about, you know, there was a discussion in a news column or social media column, and someone was asking, how do people receive or think of people who are not from India or not of a particular religion wearing the dress that relates to that, that there's a significance to the way some things are and that people shouldn't just put on the clothing as a change of clothes, yeah, you know, to understand. Do you think it's important for people to understand the significance of particular clothing before they wear it?
Yes, because that would make it, they could help them to understand why they're wearing what they do. So I believe that now that I'm in this country, that clothing is really, the difference in the clothing is attached to the difference in the weather. So in India, we wouldn't need to wear those heavy jackets and things like we do here, the boots, etc. in the winter, except if you're living in the north, and then also just for a couple of months. So mostly you'd have to wear some, you know, fabrics like cotton, light and airy, so that then you would be comfortable. And there's this concept of adapting to the local customs as well. Then you, when in Rome, do as the Romans do.
Yes.
So you can assimilate better rather than standing out, kind of. Except like I mentioned, if you have some kind of festivals, then it would look beautiful that you wore your own, you know, your own kind of traditional attire.
And so when there are festivals, I mean, sometimes at festivals, there's a marketplace where people can buy clothing that's related to the culture of the festival. Do you think it's worth the time for people to ask about what they're buying before buying something so that they would know the significance?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think I've been to this place, an Indian store called Fruitikana on Fraser Road. And there were some stores which had Indian clothes. And I'm sure it wouldn't make much sense, like I told you, that particular kind of scarf which we drape at the above this attire, which we call salwar kameez. So that is called a dupatta. So if they know that this is used to cover the upper part of women's body, then it would make sense to them. Of course, now they are very prettily decorated and embroidered with sequins and glitter, and it looks very fancy. But the reason behind this is that, and also to be, you know, adhering to religious customs, which require you to maybe drape it over your head as well, respect towards the deity being worshipped and that sort of thing. So if they know why that is, then they wouldn't just think of it like a scarf. Like here we have people just, you know, using the scarf as a neck warmer in
right.
Canada. But that is not the function of that dupatta. Like I told you, mostly it is to cover the upper body or to cover the head in respect when they are for worship in a temple. So it would be good. They would know why it exists.
Right. And so as we say today, people are getting two for one. We're getting powered by age knowledge. And then we're in a format where people speak up so that listeners can hear, but also act upon what you know. So when you know, you know. So this is one of the ways that we are welcoming people to understand the richness of the cultures that are in Canada and to find respectful ways to join, reflect in it, share in customs. Now, we are going to have a short break where we listen to a song about the world, wisdom of the world. And then when we come back, I'm going to ask you about another transition, and that transition from single life to married life. And so again, my guest is Dr. Ramona Srivasan. She is a world citizen, but now residing sometimes in Vancouver and sometimes in Toronto. So she's going to be, she's one of the people with Empowered by Age that's taken part in our training, connected with CJSF, where as a volunteer, you can learn how to do any of the particular things you would like to do with radio. So she is learning about using volume. She has done some co-hosting and will also be looking forward to segments of shows. We're going to be doing segments throughout each of our Powered by Age and segments during each of our Salua shows, where you'll hear different things in each segment. So look forward as you're learning about her today, hearing her as she elicits information from you. And if anyone in the audience is interested in being part of our Powered by Age podcast creation program, you can email me at pbaafc@gmail.com. Powered by Age, working to bring about an age-friendly city. So now we're back, continuing with Dr. Ramona, talking about the transition from single life to married life.
Hi, Charlotte. Good to be back. And yes, there was a lot of change from being single to being married. I didn't know that that transition would introduce me to a whole new world with different kinds of dress and food and music and language, to mention a few of the changes I faced when I got married to Srinivas, who was an Iyengar. Have you heard of what that is, Charlotte?
No, I don't know about that.
And yeah, so the Iyengar are Tamil-speaking Hindu Brahmins, and they follow a particular philosophy. It's known as the Vishishta Advaita philosophy, propounded by Sri Ramanujacharya. And these people, the Iyengars, they form a very close traditional community. They have a particular kind of dress and food habits and music. So that was a community to which Srinivas belonged.
And so, how were you received and adjusted or adapted to that community?
Well, it was difficult at first because I didn't understand a word of the language they spoke. That was Tamil. Although it's an Indian language, Tamil is not Sanskrit-based like other Indian languages like Hindi and Marathi, which I also speak. But it took me some time to get used to that, and I did. And then there was the dress, like I told you, Indian ladies wear the sari. Well, Iyengar Indian ladies wear a different kind of sari. It's called a 9-yard sari. And I didn't have to wear that every day, but I had to wear it for religious kind of rituals which were performed at our house. And then there was the food. Like you know, Charlotte, right, that I am a Roman Catholic, born and raised in Bombay, but I'm also a Goan. Have you heard of Goa, Charlotte?
I've heard of it, but don't know a lot about it.
Okay. So it's a very beautiful little province, you might call it, on the west coast of India. And it used to be a Portuguese colony. So the Portuguese influence is there in the customs and dress of the people, and definitely in the food. So introduction to a different kind of food when I got married was vegetarian food, and they were very traditional, very strict orthodox vegetarians who did not even use onions or garlic in their food.
Wow.
But so rice was their staple dish, but it was really amazing to find what you could do. I thought if you don't use onions or garlic, right, Charlotte, it would be pretty tasteless. But I was mistaken, because they had a wide variety of dishes, different kinds of rices. Like, have you heard of tamarind rice? There was something called tamarind rice.
Oh, okay.
And there was lemon rice and yogurt rice. And then there were a whole lot of stews, like stews or curries, lentil-based. Very, very delicious. And they called sambar and rasam. Have you ever been to a South Indian restaurant in Vancouver?
I'm not sure, because I've been to Indian restaurants, but they haven't said South Indian.
Yeah. South Indian. Okay, yeah. So you have one called JJ Dosa. I think that's downtown Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And you have another called Madras Spice. That's again at Fraser Road.
And, okay, now I know it. I know that one. Yes.
Yeah, Madras Spice, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they do serve typical dishes, and they are very, very delicious. And what was amazing is that they were made from scratch. Like, I lived with my mother-in-law, and she absolutely made everything, the spices and the batter, everything was made from scratch. Like, nothing was store-bought. So it was all a big variety. Every day there was something different and delicious. So I began to feel it's a better way of life being a vegetarian. And so I began to enjoy that part, the food.
And I think that brings out a point. You know, I'm a nutritionist and talk a lot of times with people about nutritious foods, and they say, oh, that's too expensive. But they have a perception in their head of, I don't know what it is, but the health you're exploring, that all those different types of rice that you have spoken about, if people just have a picture of one thing, or they picture, I think just the idea that this is expensive. But when you talked about everything being made from scratch, that saves a lot of money, because you aren't having the excess of processed foods put in. You're not having the excess of artificial colors, and things go further. I was taught to cook by my grandmother, and lots of things were made from scratch. And from one bag of potatoes, you might get 20 dishes. And so talking about vegetarian adapting and learning that range of things is an important thing for people to think about or consider.
Right. And it was like completely plant-based, and I mean, which has become, like, people are becoming more aware of that, right? Now, to find that being plant-based is more healthy. So that was a way of life which was strange to me, but I began to realize how it worked on my digestion. Like, it was very fiber-fueled. And about the cost you mentioned, Charlotte, in India, it was the vegetables, the fruits were all seasonal, and they were locally grown. So they were not that expensive, like, because we're not packaged, right? We're just buying them directly, almost directly from the farmers. So it was very affordable. Everyone lived on a budget. So it was great fun.
Yeah, when you mentioned Madras Spice, but one of the things that I find impressive about Vancouver, that there's so many fresh fruit and vegetable places, like along Fraser and other areas. And I thought, well, how are they staying in business? But obviously, it's because a number of people are getting plants and eating more fruits and vegetables, and finding that things, they don't have to go to some place that's an import store, that many foods that might be thought of as foods from Africa, India, the Caribbean, that there are people growing them, you know, in here in BC and Ontario as well.
Yes, yes. They must be, because we do shop for these typically Indian vegetables at least once a month, and they're quite easily available at the grocery store. I think it's called Punjab Grocery on Main 29th and Main Street. And I'm sure, pretty sure they're grown here. Like there's a kind of squash, which we call bottle gourd. And there are kind of flat beans, which are available. And so, you know, like taro. So these are some typical eggplant also dishes, which we use. And they seem to be, they're not that expensive either. So they must be locally grown. We're happy to have them.
Well, that may be in a future show. We will interview some of the farmers, because there's a lot of farmland, and there are people that are, I think during the winter, there was an awareness. There were people bringing an awareness of that, the costs and food policies that are happening in India, the treatment that's given to farm workers is something that everyone needs to be aware of and supportive of, because according to how well we treat farm workers and their health, it also reflects on the health of the plants we eat. So just increasing the awareness that people are growing some things that you think of as just foods from China, foods from India, that they are being grown right here in BC. I was going to ask you a question about intergenerational transfer, because you said you've learned a lot of things from your mother-in-law. Is that something that is a high value, that you find to be a high value, teaching children how to cook the foods within their culture, within their heritage?
Right. I feel my children were looked after. They were almost raised by my mother-in-law, because I was always busy teaching in college and writing books and tutoring students even after college at home. So I find that my children have, you know, grown up with very good values. She was very disciplined. And one thing in particular, Charlotte, she had this rule in Tamil. She would say to them, when you enter the house, always wash your hands and your feet. And now during the pandemic, that kind of struck me like a flash. I thought, my children don't need to worry about that hand sanitizing, because they have been brought up like that.
Right? Yes.
That was one. And then going to bed on time, it would be like, say, you know, other houses you would see, because our houses are very near each other, apartments. So you would see the TVs on in various people's houses. But in our house, 9 o'clock, it would be lights out.
Yes.
So they had to go to bed. But she would wake up at 5:30, and they had to wake up as well at that time. And there was some kind of devotional music which she would play. So that gave them that spiritual kind of, you know, start to their day. And then everything was like very according to schedule. They would have no trouble getting ready for school and leaving by 7 for their school bus or, you know, whatever, walking off to school. So that was one. And then also their studies, when she insisted on them learning this, the violin and that classical Indian music, it's called Carnatic classical music. I feel it had a link towards mathematics and music, like, because I found both of them were very, very good at mathematics. And I could only attribute this to learning that music, because unlike Western music, where you have the notes and you read from the sheet music, there is no sheet music. Everything is memorized. And they have to listen and play and then remember the entire thing. So that was something wonderful, of course, that they learned. My daughter still plays. My son kind of gave up in between because of his studies. So I really owe her a lot. They still maintain that disciplined approach to their lives. And it's all because of her and the values she. And up to now, they remember the things she said, like, you know, when you're everyone in the house is getting ready to go and someone's lagging behind and the time is up and you have to leave. But she had this phrase in which she would say, I'm ready. So both of them say that thing in Tamil. Like, you know, they get ready and everyone is running and scared. But they say, I'm ready, because that's how she taught them, them to be. So it is really wonderful, the impact that one person can have on the lives of others. Really good. Great. What about you, Charlotte? Have you had such an experience in your life?
Yes. And I was going to say, you know, one of the things that we've been talking about is the reservoir of practices and skills that older people have. You know, a few years before the pandemic, people had this joke saying, boomer, as if, you know, a lot of our practices were useless or old fashioned. But some of the things that have, I've been recently doing work on LinkedIn and doing things with my resume. And a person was saying, oh, don't put, you know, seasoned skills or whatnot. But then another person said, they are looking for people who have got habits, critical thinking habits, habits of making notes, not being dependent on systems, because there have been so many times this summer that Google has gone down, the different Wi-Fi have gone down. And if you're totally dependent on all of those things, instead of having a notebook, one of the hallmarks of our generation, nothing can get done. So yes, my grandmother taught everyone of her, my grandmother and grandfather raised six children of their own and two of family members that something had happened, whether the person passed on. We never knew what, because everyone was raised as one of their children. But she taught everyone from 2 years old how to cook. And so at the time that I was two, my father had been called up to go back onto, you know, go over to Europe to whatever remnants there were of the war in 45, 46. But I was staying with my grandparents, and around the time that I was 18 months or so, she had me washing vegetables, and then as I was older, I would go for walks with her. And on Tuesday, this is the thing too about habits, that you do particular things on particular days. Tuesdays, she would go out walking. Well, after a while, she let me go with her, and she had a stick that was forked at the end. And I was so curious about that stick. And she had a satchel that went across her shoulder. She had a little croaker sack that had one to go across my shoulder. So I came to learn she was using that stick to part different plants, because there were some things that she would use for medicines and she would put it in one part of her bag. And then some things she would show me how to use the little fork, you know, little bend in the little part, use that part to pull up things. But she also one day used it to grab a snake. There was a snake ahead, and I was just amazed that she had right at the right at the V, she had it by the neck and she threw it away. So
that's fine.
It stayed in my mind. She didn't kill the snake. She got it out of our way. She didn't scream and holler and faint. She just did it so matter of factly.
Right. Yeah. That's wonderful, Charlotte. So you learned some basic cooking, right?
Oh, yes. How to wash the vegetables. She would let me break things up. And it worked for me in my career as a nutritionist. One of the things that I did as a project was cooking with preschool children whose parents said, oh, these children won't eat any vegetables. And so I had the kids wash vegetables, break the things up, see what went into the pot. And they came for a lunch that the kids had prepared. And here they were eating this variety of vegetables. So it really put in my mind an appreciation for learning that I could, you know, small children can do things with food. And you don't have to take, I was talking to one parent group once, and the person said that their child would only eat this particular sandwich from a company that has arches. And I said, could you please show me the child's driving license? Because in your home, you know, you have the opportunity as children are involved with food. So that was one of the things I loved from her. And also smell. And you mentioned the spices. There were so many things she would let me smell it. Well, in college, when I had college foods, we had a tray and there were 100 different spices we had to be able to identify by color and smell. But because my grandmother had had me used to doing that, I could really distinguish a lot of things on the tray by their color and their smell. So I think that welcoming, just as in your family, you welcomed someone to work with your children, that other people who have children, you know, welcoming the older people if, in their family, if they don't live where their parent is, there is somebody in your building. Getting to know people that are in your building and neighborhood and having a friendship, not looking at having an older person as, oh, I'm going to have to take care of them, or, oh, they're going to be so much trouble. Look at the magic of the stories that we have to tell. Look at the magic of little crafts and things that children do remember, just as you remember those things as you grow up, just as right. I remember about the snake and how to tell when gingerbread is ready by the smell. That it's right. really important to connect to the reservoir of skills and knowledge that older people have and to put them to work.
Right, right.
Like, I thought, I wish I knew how to drive the ferry boats, because somehow whoever was in planning forgot to look at, oh, we hired all these group of people between 46 and 56. They're all going to be retiring. We should be bringing some people in, you know, at that midpoint so that they could learn from the people who've been there. So I think these are things, as we talk about election issues and we talk about things to make into policies, to really tap into the hard skills and the reservoir of knowledge and experiences people over 55 have.
Yeah, absolutely.
You made a reference to, again, a transition in teaching, transition from the people that you had taught when they were teens to meeting you again in later in life. What are some of the transitions that you have observed in working with and teaching?
I began my career teaching in school, high school. So from that to, I moved to teaching undergraduates. And I found that a big change. In school, I found the students were very loving and very devoted to the teacher, and they formed a very close bond. Maybe we spent longer hours with them, and that was the reason for that. And those were the students whom I mentioned I met, like, say, about 40 years after teaching them. But they remembered various things I did for them, which was very amazing. And to me, I didn't think much of that, but then they remembered, which was really great. Like, I taught them songs. Like, again, the students belonged to a different community than I did. And their languages were also different. The music was different. So, but I loved singing, and I insisted on their learning those songs and wrote them on the board. And they sang, of course, just because they had to listen to the teacher. But then 40 years later, you would hardly expect them to remember, which they did. But in the undergraduates, I found that once they're grown up, they become a little distant, and they're not that easy, like malleable. They already have now developed some fixed ideas, and it's difficult to change their ways of thinking. But we have a chance to use some of our innovative ideas to overcome that as well. So I remember teaching them history of China, and just to make it more interesting to them, we had a Chinese festival, and so some students wrote some, you know, important philosophers, their quotes on the blackboard, and some others made some interesting Chinese dishes and brought it to class. And we invited the staff from the other faculties as well. And everyone really enjoyed it. So I found that worked for the older group. They had a chance to show their skills, and that made them more interested in that part of history.
Yes, the new buzzword for that is experiential learning.
Okay, that's what they call it, okay.
And some people are given an option now, which, because not everyone receives or utilizes teaching in the same way, that to just, some people are visual learners, others are tactile learners, others are kinesthetic. And so when you had in the classroom an opportunity for people to cook a dish as opposed to telling you about it from an encyclopedia, it, you know, is a very valuable alternative.
And yes, because I don't know how it works here in Canada, but in India we have a very tight schedule of the syllabus, and we are expected to, we have about 4 important examinations during the year, and for each examination we are expected to cover a certain amount of the syllabus. So then it becomes a little difficult if you have to cover the syllabus and introduce this kind of style of teaching. But I definitely found that the impact it had on the students was wonderful. They became more interested in the subject. Normally they feel like history is boring, you know, they don't want to attend, and attendance is not compulsory in college as opposed to school. So that was another surprise to me. I used to wonder, where are all the students? There's supposed to be 120 in my class, but there are just about half of them. So, but then when they had this kind of festival that we did, I also allowed some of them to speak of their famous favorite Chinese leader, like say Dr. Sun Yat-sen or Mao Zedong. So that gave them an opportunity for, you know, their oratorial skills. So, and then when they told the others who were not there, so the attendance in the class also improved. So that was, it was good. Couldn't do it much, but I did try, like, you know, to have a small discussion. Like I had put up every day, I'd put up a small saying of a good philosopher, and then I'd ask someone to read and someone else to express what they thought about it, just to have something different from the subject per se. What are your experiences, Charlotte?
I had a seventh grade teacher named Mrs. Swisher. I still remember Mrs. Swisher because she would put quotes on the wall. And one of them was, if gold should rust, what can we expect of nails? And so if she went outside of the classroom, she had the expectation that we would continue doing what we were supposed to do. And if there was the least noise inside, she had a long pointer and she would just come in and she would just tap that sign. So, you know, that has stuck with me, as well as being in the science fair. I went to school in Kansas, and Kansas was a de facto segregated, meaning that there were still schools that were just for pretty much all the teachers were Black, all the students were Black, and but there were things, a lot of the teachers, some of our teachers had master's degrees, and projects, I just remember in every class there was a project, particularly around the science fair. One class we had to learn about toads, and they, you know, my mother was mortified that they told us to go out and find a pond, find some place that we could get a toad, and then we could just watch them. And so those things, the projects, stand out more in my mind for things that I had to learn than the textbooks. You know, they didn't just say, you know, read the solar system. We had an assignment to go out and look at the clouds, I mean, look at the sky, and try and map and put the positions. So at that time, the skies were not as fogged up with all of the emissions of different things. But I just think that the teachers, like you have done that, and other teachers who felt that it's better to give a life example or how much more something is anchored in when kids have, according to their skill level and their interest level, when everybody's given a chance to present something from the way that they see it. So many mothers made that, not silly putty, but we had to do paper mache. I asked my nieces and nephews now, do you all have to do a paper mache project? Or I asked my grandson, and, you know, as he was in a junior high, didn't you all have to make a paper mache project? Because we had to make a globe. There were at least 3 different classes where we made this paper mache, and one was the, you know, it was the earth, it was something else. But I think that that's an important thing to look at with learning, that it's not just all computer programs, the computer grades, the simulations, where it's just touching things with keys or touching virtual worlds, but having people have an opportunity to use things that are in their house or that observe the climate and be able to make things that relate to what's happening in the world and not just things that are virtual. Because we virtually, we could be out of space at any day. Virtually, all of the systems could go down. And then people say, I can't teach because, you know, the net is down. So I think, you know, you as a teacher, with having provided these different alternative ways to learning something, give people the idea, you know, to think beyond the critical thinking. Well, if this isn't working, well, this is another way I can get my work done. Instead of some of the chaos people had at, you know, the local colleges around finals, the COVID rules said people need this amount of space. You know, there was another rule on when and where something had to be done. And some people didn't get their finals done just because there wasn't really alternative pathways for people to present what they had learned.
And I also feel, Charlotte, that education should be to some extent value-based. And for me, I did try to introduce it to the school in which I taught had students of a very affluent status. Their parents were mostly entrepreneurs. And so there was a place where they were, shall I say, foster. The children were like, it was a kind of orphanage. So we could sponsor a child and visit that orphanage. So we used to do it once a year. And we could take things for, you know, students that students would like pencils, erasers, notebooks, small kind of gifts. And the children would bring these from their homes. So they became aware that, and they would accompany me to that orphanage and meet our child. And so at least they became aware that, yes, there are people who are not as fortunate as they to appreciate their own good fortune and to be, you know, generous to share some of it with others who are less fortunate. So from that to recently, those students have also, you know, teachers in India, school teachers were not that highly paid. And so once they've retired, maybe they're not doing so well. So these students formed an organization where they felicitated the teachers, and then they gave them some kind of honorarium. And that was, I thought, a good thing, because that lesson about trying to share your fortune with those who are less fortunate, that stayed with them and helped the teachers in turn after they had retired.
Yeah, that's an important thing that I see, you know, happening within Canada, that there is a kind of consciousness of giving back, you know, that there are people who are looking for caregivers they had, teachers they had, but really doing celebrations, sometimes writing things about the people, that's something that's you know, still a value here.
That's great. That's great to hear.
Well, we have touched on some key points of transition. You have a wonderful, enriched life of support. We didn't get to talk about it today, but at another point, we're going to talk about spirituality and mindfulness and how much you have seen, you know, the changes that we've had to go through, the stressful things that we've endured in the past 2 years of so much change. But you've advocated that people take a time and even done some exercises with us around mindfulness and meditation and also chanting. So is there a parting thought on mindfulness or in that spiritual realm that you would like to share?
Yes, I think it's very important. From all my experiences, I feel that it's very important to stay in the moment, to be present, rather than worrying about, you know, what's going to happen. That can cause a lot of stress. And more than that, being grateful. Mm-hmm. Starting your day with that, ending your day with that. That is really valuable, making us leading a very productive and positive life. So these are my two takeaways from transition.
Well, again, we have had Dr. Ramona talking with us about transition, sharing some of her transitions, and just the notion that transition is a part of life, and that as we transition from one generation to the other, looking at the strengths we can share, there's some things that people can do faster, other things that people need the wisdom of slowing down, looking at the value of connecting, some of our audiences are college students, some are people that are in or working parents, and then we have others that are older, but looking at the things that we can share among. So somebody can get on the computer real fast, but sometimes get confused by the information not being relevant or the information being too shocking. They can get overwhelmed. But as you said, having this practice and a lifestyle, being able to talk with someone who does use meditation, who does use focus, can help them. So I think just looking at the strengths that we have, we can transition to being a healthier, happier society, and we can transition to having an age-friendly city, a city that works well for people 8 to 80 is what we're working toward through Powered by Age, and also with Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon. So again, if you would like to be a part of this group that looks for stories to share, if you have creative arts that you would like to share, we have poets, we have writers, all of these are kinds of things that you will be seeing on our summer smorgasbords of programs aired on CJSF Radio 90.1 Burnaby, CJSF.ca, streaming worldwide. So I'm Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C. And when people ask me what time it is, I say it's always love time, poem time. Love time, poem time, love time, poem time, love time, poem time, time for words from heaven to shine. Love time, poem time, time for words to pattern and rhyme. Love time, poem time, time for words to wash the wounds, bind the lashes, and play bassoon. Love time, poem time, time for poems, poets, and singers. Time to untie all life's ringers. Poem time, love time, time for you to reveal to me. Unravel all your mystery. Time for joy and utter grace. Rest from toiling in this place. Place of poems, place of words. Place for love instead of swords. Love time, poem time, love time. Love time, poem time, times for words from heaven to shine. Love time, poem time, time for words to pattern and rhyme. Love time, poem time, times for words to wash the wounds, bind the lashes and play bassoon. Love time, poem time, poem time, love time. Time for poems, poets, singers. Time to untie all life's ringers. Time for you to reveal to me, unravel all your mystery. Time for joy and utter grace, rest from toiling in this place. Place of poems, place of words, place for love instead of swords. Love time, poem time, poem time, love time, love time, poem time, poem time, love time.